This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to beat Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
So today, we're going to take a look at Microsoft losing its battle to acquire TikTok. We're getting all the reaction to that.
Plus, why ESG is set to outpace gold.
But first, we have to look at tech IPOs. Our next guest points out that Snowflake's triple-digit top-line growth and cloud leadership is going to make it one of the highest-profile IPOs for 2020. And you know what? It did just that. We welcome Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Mandeep Singh. I mean, okay, I have so many questions. And the first is, like, how did the company leave so much money on the table?
Well, so with this kind of an IPO, and you know, the IPO market wasn't tested that well prior to Snowflake. In this case, you know, investors have different ways of looking at a company. Yes, the Snowflake IPO stands out in terms of its metrics, but then there is the option dilution aspect of it, which I don't think this market cared about right now, but they have about 70 million options. So if you include that, the valuation is really off the charts. And in this case, I guess investors ignored it for now. So from time and again, you know, you come across situations where an IPO really takes off on day one. And to an extent, it was warranted with Snowflake, given, you know, this is a rare company in terms of its prospects.
I tell you, as a former investment banker, I don't know about this. I mean, here's a stock that IPO'd at 120, more than doubled on its first day of trading. That's tens of billions of dollars of value left on the table. So I suspect the company is going to have a conversation with their bankers. But let's step back a little bit, Mandeep. What does Snowflake even do?
Oh, good question. You win.
Yeah, and so Snowflake is really an analytics company. You know, all that talk about big data analytics on the cloud, well, no one really did it well so far. You had a company like Cloudera, which IPO'd a couple of years back, but they didn't have much success with that. So there was a void in the market in terms of really doing the analytics on the cloud, really going across clouds, because there is a lock-in. If you are using an Amazon cloud for analytics, they have an offering called Redshift, which does very similar to what Snowflake does. So the point was that you had to go across clouds when it comes to analytics, and that's the whole point of, you know, combining your different data sets from different systems. And Snowflake really is that offering that can go across clouds, that has pre-built integrations with all these different types of clouds that are out there. And that's really the kind of the value proposition. Now, they really stood out in terms of their metrics. Like I said, their net retention rate, which is a key metric to compare cloud companies, that's 157%. What that means is, even if they don't add any customers, they're adding 50% more incremental revenue every year at their existing customers. That's huge. That's best in class. And I think that's one of the reasons why really there is so much excitement around the company's prospects.
Does it have competitors?
Well, the competitors are the cloud vendors like Amazon AWS, Microsoft Azure, Google Cloud. But the problem is, as a customer who is using these clouds, you get logged in. If you're using AWS, chances are that you are not going to be able to use Microsoft Azure for analytics. So that data that sits in Microsoft Azure can't be combined with the data that's in Amazon. So Snowflake really sits on top of these clouds. Now, all these clouds, like I said, give you analytics, but then you don't want to go with that option because you are getting logged in.
All right. So this is kind of it sounds to me kind of a derivative play or an additive play on the cloud. How do they grow? Tell me how they generate revenue. Is it just simply signing up customers and then charging those customers more and more?
Yeah. And in this case, it's really a function of the amount of data that the company is generating and it's looking to analyze. So we know the amount of data around us is growing exponentially simply because there are so many sources out there, the digital transformations, the social media. There is so much data, and it's growing at a very fast clip. Guess what? That's how Snowflake charges its customers. It's based on the consumption of data.
So basically, if I used like Amazon Cloud and then I also use Microsoft Cloud, this is what I'd have to own to be able to have them all talk to each other, right?
To be able to analyze data that's stored in all those clouds. So you yes, it's one way to aggregate everything. Mm-hmm. That's what you're doing. You're aggregating. Even you can go beyond Amazon and Microsoft. Look at Salesforce. Look at Workday. These are all the, you know, the applications that are really ubiquitous right now when you look at large enterprises. How do you consolidate and aggregate that data? Snowflake is the answer.
All right, Mandeep, I'm going to ask a CFA level 3 question for you.
Oh, boy.
Does this company make any money?
Well, no. So that's
I knew it. I think none of Mandeep's companies make any money.
What is that about?
I know.
Well, they are high growth companies. They get a pass for the top line growth. And in this case, this is a software company, and they are spending a ton of money on adding customers. So the customer acquisition cost means they are hiring a lot of sales force, and adding a lot of R&D headcount.
Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Bloomberg Intelligence Analyst Mandeep Singh.
Coming up on the program, why analysts are calling Microsoft's failure to acquire TikTok a win for the tech giant.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, Microsoft did not win its pursuit of acquiring viral video app TikTok. For more on what that means for the tech giant, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Anurag Rana. Anurag, I saw your React research note that you put out when the news hit, and you said, hey, this could actually be a win for Microsoft. What do you mean by that?
So I'm very happy because I would rather Microsoft focus on their enterprise business, on cloud, on collaboration apps, Teams, rather than, you know, trying to go off on another consumer experiment, which so far haven't, you know, worked out for them.
So, but, I mean, what did they want out of TikTok? And, like, what would be the value in that that they may have to go somewhere else to get it? Like, at some point, somewhere along the line, it must have made some sense to them.
See, I think the sense is to be able to say that, you know, we are hosting cloud applications for such a large applications. We are guaranteeing the safety and the privacy of all the consumer, and then you start selling this as a service to other, you know, providers out there. And given the size of Microsoft's cloud portfolio, I think it was very logical. I mean, for me, it just doesn't make sense that, you know, somebody like Oracle will do it because their cloud portfolio is not as strong as either Amazon or Microsoft.
So I guess from the Oracle perspective, is it simply a way, A, Larry Ellison doing a favor for his pal President Trump, B, from a business perspective, is it simply I'm going to get a lot of traffic onto my Oracle cloud platform and that'll be a way for me to kind of beef up my market share?
That's the whole thing because, frankly, you know, they were able to get one marquee customer not too long ago, Zoom, and they're constantly talking about how Zoom is on Oracle's cloud platform. And, you know, they're doing so well. So if they can get a few more customers, you know, maybe they would jumpstart that particular business because, frankly, you know, they have been so far behind that, that particular area, despite being around for so long in that area.
What do you think made Microsoft want to take on the Trump administration in all of this? Because, you know, Paul hinted at it. I mean, I don't know. Did you really hint at it? But, like, Larry Ellison and President Trump have a much different relationship than, like, Microsoft, Satya Nadella, and President Trump.
See, I think Microsoft is in favor right now in, with the entire government because they won a very large contract instead of Amazon, which we know that, you know, doesn't go – is not the best favored company to work with the government right now. So they've already won a very large contract. And then, you know, this would have been another feather in their cap because if they would have hosted this, you know, they would go out and about to sell similar services to others. But frankly, you know, my bigger issue was, why spend billions of dollars to do this? You know, you should organically be able to grow that business without any help of, you know, one or two of these marquee clients.
All right, well, I'm looking at this stock, Microsoft, up 31% this year to date, market cap of just under $1.6 trillion. So the market certainly likes the strategy that this company is pursuing. Talk to us, Mandeep. I know one of the key drivers that I know you focus on and a lot of analysts and investors focus on is the cloud for Microsoft. Where are they kind of competitive-wise relative to Amazon and the others in the market?
So, you know, different portions of the cloud, in the infrastructure piece of it, they're still much smaller than Amazon. But frankly, over the past few years, they have closed the gap very, very well. In fact, if you look at the cloud infrastructure right now, it's only Amazon and Microsoft. And then Google is, you know, Google and Alibaba are actually the other ones. But in cloud applications, you know, Amazon's is not a player in that. But in Microsoft is a very big player there because of their Office 365 application. They also have a portfolio of Dynamics products called Dynamics CRM, where they provide Salesforce-like capability to, you know, their clients. So Microsoft has a much more holistic cloud portfolio than Amazon, but in cloud infrastructure, you know, they are behind.
How discretionary is Microsoft?
We don't think it is, because 90% of their commercial revenue is annuity-based. So if you have a large, you know, if you have a large customer, they would be, you know, buying several of Microsoft's products, whether it's Office, whether it's the operating system, whether it's the database. So Microsoft, we think, is one of the least susceptible to any economic downturn than, you know, any of the software companies out there.
Talk to us about the analytics part of the cloud business. We just had a company, Snowflake, have a huge IPO last week with just wildly successful IPO. Where is Microsoft in performing the analytics services and products to its customers?
So when any of these larger companies, whether it's Amazon or whether it's Microsoft or Google, sell their cloud platform to customers, they also give them the ability to, you know, basically pull in a lot of the data from their on-premise systems or the applications that they're running into their cloud platform and able to run analytics on top of it. But remember, a lot of the times that's very specific to the cloud that you're using or the product that they're using. When you have other companies out there that can do it irrespective of what cloud platform you use or what on-premise platform you use, sometimes it's a better value proposition for the client.
What is going to be sort of the next leg here? I mean, how richly valued do you feel like is Microsoft, or where are they not getting credit for part of their business right now?
You know, it's a tough thing to say that just about the software space in general is far more overvalued than any time I have seen, you know, over the past 15, 20 years. In fact, we just put out a note, you know, just a couple of weeks ago that currently, you know, the whole space is trading close to 1.5 to 2 standard deviations above its, you know, 3-year average in price to sales.
Wow.
You know, just to give you some context, I mean, again, I forgot at what point, you know, Snowflake is not, what, 60, 70 billion market cap? And I don't think, you know, their revenue run rate is not even a billion at this point. So you think about it on a price to sales basis, what multiple people are paying for, you know, some of these companies. Perhaps this is the only place where there's growth in town. But having said that, you know, to pay a multiple that's just egregious in my view, you know, you have to figure out what is the long-term proposition of it. And I think it'll take a few years for us to figure out whether these kinds of valuations are justified or not.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence senior analyst Anurag Rana.
All right, coming up on the program, how a Biden win could actually impact your defense dollars.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It is 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Our next guest points out the Joe Biden election win could actually threaten defense funding. We're pleased to welcome Bloomberg Intelligence aerospace and autos industry analyst Douglas Rothacker. Hey, Douglas, it's good to chat. So give us a thesis.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So I think the defense sector has been increasingly, pricing in for some months now the probability of a Joe Biden election win. And Joe Biden has talked pretty broadly about not cutting defense spending. Although when you think about the other initiatives that he's discussed, most notably and recently the climate change initiatives that he would undertake in his administration, these are the type of things that you would in theory risk crowding out, as they say, the money that would be allotted for defense spending. So if I had to ballpark it, I'd probably say the consensus is probably for a low to mid-single digit cut in defense spending. So by no means is it a drastic cut, but headwinds for the sector nonetheless. But I think broadly positive, comments about investing in technology and new systems, I think are kind of positive drivers there for the sector, regardless of the cuts that are potentially coming.
So, Doug, give us a sense. You mentioned there might be some headwinds with a Democratic administration. Talk to us about the extent of the tailwinds that the Defense Department has seen in terms of funding from the Trump administration. Has it been noticeable?
It has been noticeable. I mean, double-digit revenue growth across the large U.S. defense names over the past few years, as we had this recent bump in the defense budget. Key programs, notably the F-35, B-21, to give some examples, have been well-funded and have, improved the top and bottom lines of Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman. And so they are, they've backlogs have really been boosted pretty considerably. So it'll get them another year or two of, I would say solid low to mid-single-digit growth here for the defense sector. It'll take some time, if there is some potential cuts, for that to roll down through the sector and then through the supply chain. But they have seen some tailwinds over the past few years from the recent upcycle in defense spending.
Well, I was going to say, in terms of the timing, how quickly do cuts or increases in spending filter through? It's not like all of a sudden you're going to cut and tomorrow Raytheon can manufacture stuff.
That's correct. So they've built sizable backlogs, and two, there's typically a 1 to 2 year lag between when that money actually gets spent and flows down through the defense industrial base from when it's budgeted. So while you're hearing right now about the FY21 defense budget, those type of things, typically for the long cycle businesses that you would get in a Lockheed or a Boeing defense businesses, those type of things take a couple years to trickle down through to have an impact. So the near-term window, I would say, for the defense sector is really pretty robust. Margins are very healthy. Again, top line is growing through, I would say, at least 2021 at a mid-single-digit clip collectively. There was some near-term challenges here in the first half of the year related to COVID and some manufacturing and supply chain disruptions that should improve as we get into the second half. So I think that's probably just a blip on the radar, if you will. And to put things in broader context, I mean, the last down cycle in defense spending was peak to trough about 20%. So, even in a Biden administration, maybe at worst, a mid-single digit cut at percentage basis is maybe $20 billion. So by no means is it dramatic. Discussion of funding key investments and new programs, I think, is broadly positive.
So, Doug, I'm guessing that a lot of investors in these defense stocks are looking back to their notes and seeing, what defense spending actually did under the Obama and Biden administration. What was the evidence there? What was the history?
So, in the early years of the Obama administration, as we pulled back from engagement in the Middle East and sequestration took hold, and Congress negotiated budgets, there was kind of mid-single-digit annual cuts in defense spending. A lot of that was short-cycle businesses related to maintenance and, again, overseas engagement. I don't see those dynamics necessarily playing out again, but it is, I would say, fresh in investors' minds. I don't think there's going to be a drawdown in defense spending like we saw with the last cycle. Mm-hmm. Lockheed Martin, Northrop, and Boeing are pretty well-positioned among the major Air Force programs And Shipbuilders is going to be Hunting Ingalls and General Dynamics there as well.
All right. Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence Aerospace and Autos Industry Analyst Douglas Rothaker.
Coming up on the program, why ESG ETFs are set to outpace metals.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Another sign of the new normal times we're living in is ESG is set to outpace gold. I want to welcome Bloomberg Intelligence head of ESG and thematic investing for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, Adeline Diop. So, Adeline, what's the correlation slash causation here between, say, the gold safety assets versus ESG?
Hi, Alex. So, first, ESG has dominated fund investment along with gold this year. And both strategies have been considered a refuge providing protection against market declines over the years. But we believe ESG investing is also positioned for growth and designed to benefit from the green fiscal packages and the positive outlook for a COVID-19 vaccine for three reasons. So the first one is that ESG has been considered as an alternative to low volatility strategy together with gold. But as opposed to gold, ESG has a much longer and steady runway that not only offers downside protection, but also exposure to high profitability, high growth, and momentum factors based on the BI factor scorecard. The second reason is that ESG ETFs tend to be overweight materials and industrials, while underweight energy. So positioning supported by the BI latest strategy sector scorecard. So the outlook for materials, for instance, is positive because billions are going to be invested in green-based infrastructure, energy, transportation, benefiting from the green fiscal stimulus. And the sector also benefits from strong technical signals, according to our strategies, which are price, breadth, and earnings momentum. Meanwhile, the outlook for the energy sector remains bleak because the sector faces a long-term structural decline despite the current valuation, as the world accelerates towards more the global energy transition away from fossil fuel, as the CEO of Trafigura, for instance, said recently. And the third reason is that ESG ETFs tend to also be overweight in healthcare. And such sector positioning may continue to deliver returns as the hopes for a COVID-19 vaccine improve. And almost half of the European ETF, for instance, top 10 holdings include companies such as Roche, GlaxoSmithKline, or even Sanofi that could benefit from not only the vaccine, but also the testing rate. And healthcare also remains at the top of the BI strategy sector scorecard.
All right. So, Adeline, a lot of stuff there, a lot to unpack. Let's go back to the original thesis here about relative to gold, because I guess gold has always been recognized as a safe haven for investors. But you're making the case here that a quality ETF or ESG ETF made up of quality companies can, in fact, also be a safe haven. Is that your contention?
So, yes. In April, we wrote that ESG was mimicking gold because it was recognized as a low-vol strategy. It was ranking high also on the factor scorecard, that it's really a low, high-quality stock that are really where people feel increasingly comfortable that they provide a resilient strategy, similarly to gold. And what we're saying now is that, for the three reasons I just mentioned earlier, is that ESG now is not just a refuge, but perfectly suited for the economic recovery. And it's, so it has a much more a longer runway, and it's also positioned for growth. So it's a resilient yet competitive investment strategy by design.
I mean, it kind of sounds perfect if you were going to like create the perfect asset to help you outperform in bad times and also give you some alpha. The critics, though, say that, look, it wound up performing well during the downturn, but then the second you get some kind of recovery, boom, you're going to be selling it just like you would gold and go buy something else.
So, yes, but so this is why the in-depth analysis was done, which was interesting, is that we think it's going to outpace gold because of actually, so it's sector exposure, where you really have, thanks to the cherry picking, I guess, the ESG analysis when looking at stocks and what you're going to more overweight rather than underweight, is that it tends to overweight high profitability stocks. And then their positioning is for this crisis and recovery is quite a natural fit. Again, being overweight materials and industrials and pharma, whilst underweight energy.
All right. How have fund flows been in ESG ETFs, Adelaine, kind of during this prior 6 months? Is a message getting out that ETFs that focus on ESG are performing well?
Well, yeah. So ESG flows and gold flows have dominated all ETFs this year. If you look at Europe, the growth of flows in both has been similar, about 100, almost 200% for ESG funds and a little bit over 200% for gold. So it's very similar. Yet ESG inflows in volumes were higher for ESG than gold. That was a surprise. In the US, the picture is slightly different because gold flows were higher than ESG in terms of growth and volume. But still, ESG grew over 300%. So this indicates that the biggest ETF market, the U.S., is really waking up to ESG. It's hardly 1%. ESG is hardly 1% of the ETF market in the U.S., but it is undergoing the fastest growth. And another indication that that is going in this direction is that in the U.S., all smart beta ETF flows dropped 63% since the beginning of the year, yet ESG ETF grew threefold compared to 2019. So this really reinforces our view that ESG flows have a really a longer runway relative to gold, which may be maturing.
Do we know who the investors are yet?
At the moment, it's we haven't gone through this analysis in detail, but we would want to comfortably say, given like the analysis from other colleagues, that it has been institutional investors. Mm. But interestingly enough, the retail sector is getting extremely interested because of everything that happened this year between the COVID-19 crisis, the climate crisis, just at the moment in the U.S. All the uncertainties that have been growing, that the retail investor is now much more aware of environmental concerns, climate hazards from the wildfires to the hurricanes and the climate risks and physical risks how the fiscal packages are going to support electric vehicles and green buildings. So the retail investor is waking up to ESG, which is going to provide another liquidity pool.
Really interesting. It's so fascinating to see this market develop as we go. Bloomberg Intelligence, head of ESG and thematic investing for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, Adelaine Dabb. Thank you.
Well, it's time to switch gears to trade. China's phase one U.S. agricultural purchases down at least 51%. It's threatening the 2021 recovery. To help us make sense of it all, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence industry analyst Chris Cialino. Chris, thanks so much for joining us here. Talk to us about this trade deal, and a big part of the trade deal, certainly from the president's perspective, was that China was going to step up purchases of U.S. agricultural products. Give us just a scorecard of where we are now.
Yeah, that really has kind of failed to materialize thus far. Despite the phase one trade deal, we think China is going to fall well short of its ag purchase commitment of about $36.5 billion this year. Total ag exports are only up a modest 5% year to date, and that's kind of already over depressed 2019 levels. If you look at soybeans, which is one of our largest exports, they're down almost 60%. We estimate that China's ag purchases are actually running about 54% below the phase one deal pace, just based on historical buying patterns, which makes really achieving this deal almost unattainable with only a few months left in the year. The pace currently implies about $16.8 billion of U.S. ag purchases in 2020, which would be the lowest ag exports to China in the last decade if you exclude the last 2 years, which were disrupted by the trade war.
Well, but how much of that is a COVID thing versus like they're just not following through? Like, how do we distinguish?
Yeah, so COVID, I think, has had an impact on that. We really haven't seen either side place a lot of blame on COVID. Undoubtedly, it has disrupted trade flows, particularly earlier in the year. But we haven't seen that kind of emerge as really an excuse for the lack of buying. Historically, China does buy a lot of crops at the end of the year, particularly soybeans after harvest time. So I would expect that there's going to be a lot of buying towards the end of the year as well. But the fact that we're running so far below the current pace, to do that much of a catch-up at the end of the year, it's just not achievable.
So it's interesting here. Give us a sense of the impact on the farmers here, because I think obviously they count so much on the Chinese market and the Chinese demand. What if the farmers doing in response here?
Yeah, you're right. China is a critical trade partner for U.S. farmers. It was the largest export market for U.S. farmers prior to the trade war. Roughly 15 to 20% of all our ag exports went to China prior to the trade dispute. So it is a critical market for them. Farmer sentiment has been pretty resilient, actually, this year, despite the export market uncertainty, despite the low crop prices that we've had. They've actually hung in there. Part of that could be attributed to, you know, they've gotten several rounds of government aid. So that has helped kind of cushion the blow here.
Okay, thanks very much. It was great to get the perspective. Bloomberg Intelligence industry analyst Christopher Cialino.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.